Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 70 of Dominaria's Judgment, a weekly Constructed Magic podcast brought to you by me, Dom Harvey, along with Ari Lax. This episode will not be quite as nice as last week's, where we were joined by Bobby Fortinelli to go for a deep dive on Mono Green Devotion in Pioneer, which I think if you're planning to play that deck or really play any Pioneer anytime soon, that episode is recommended listening for sure. But we are back to our usual fare here, going over a lot of modern results and a lot of just specific cards and interactions in the modern format, because Dominaria United really has done a number on all of the assumptions we made previously.
One card has been a big headliner. This is like very much the case as it was with Streets of New Capenna. There were like five-ish cards that were expected to be big hits, and then like one card kind of took over the format, and things have sort of rebalanced to the point where Ledger Shredder is just a piece of the puzzle and not like the big headline of the format. We're still in that early stage with Leyline Binding, and that's really what we're going to be talking about this week, is Leyline Binding's impact on the modern format.
And those two sets being back-to-back, I think, is a crucial piece of that puzzle, because if we didn't have the completed cycle of triumphs now with Streets of New Capenna, and that was, if nothing else, we knew that that would be the set's lasting impact. If there were really no spells to write home about in a few months, just completing that cycle would have ripple effects by itself. But especially with the domain mechanic, and specifically Leyline Binding coming just a few months after that, I do wonder if the mana-based puzzles that we are all faced with now would look quite different if we didn't have all of these different options to choose between.
Yeah, it helps. It simultaneously doesn't help a lot and makes massive changes. I don't really know. People would still be doing the Leyline Binding thing. There would just be weird exclusions of other cards. And we'll get to a little bit of that discussion later, because the combinations of how your mana lines up with a fast Leyline Binding get really tricky as you reduce the number of triomes and fetches and all that stuff. But when you have them all, you can kind of build something that sort of does whatever you want.
Yeah, we'll save all of the ins and outs there for our main segment. First, we'll get into the results, and then before that, we'll get into some brief housekeeping. As always, you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/dominarias_judgment, and we thank Duncan Malone, among others, for taking the leap and joining us there. You can find us on Twitter at twitter.com/dominaria_pod, and you can find us in the Discord, where there's been a lot of back and forth this week in particular, although a lot of that is just canister popping in every now and again to just challenge outlandish statements being made by sometimes one of us or sometimes other people as well.
Usually me.
Yeah, so if you want to see the two of them going at it live, then you can do that over there in the Discord, along with a healthy dollop of nonsense throughout the week to satiate your appetite in the meantime. So that's it for the housekeeping, and now for the results. We have a lot to get to, both online and offline. So we'll start with the Saturday Challenge, won by Living End, a deck which really oscillates between just like litmus test of the format, one of the best decks, if not the best deck, and just disappearing, like taking a temporary vacation, but back on top this weekend. And the specific story of this finals, of Living End beating Creativity, I think is a big part of why it might be coming back in full force here, where if you remember that MTG data, I think it was a matchup matrix, which again, with all of the usual caveats about the reliability of that data, the Living End versus Creativity matchup was one of the most lopsided in the entire format, according to that data. And I don't know if it's quite that bad, but that does generally chime with my experience of it too. And so in a world where Creativity perhaps now is the deck to beat, Living End coming back as a response to that, on top of just being incredibly powerful in its own right, makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, that matchup is, if the Creativity player plays extremely skewed and very well in a lot of ways, winnable for Creativity, and that's as far as I'll go. It is not great. There's like a lot of really sort of weird stuff. Like, I believe Archon of Cruelty doesn't work through a Leyline of Sanctity. Like, things like that going on. There's also like this Creativity list is sort of interesting in the finals. I do want to comment on Mana Leak showing up, which like four Mana Leak or four Spell Pierce and two Mana Leak really represents a change towards trying to cut like. This list does not have the hard evidences that were part of the deck early on, and then it doesn't have the Teferis that were part of the deck earlier than that, and have looped back around. So it's like some amount of interaction, but yeah, it's not enough to really stop living in. I don't even know if Teferi would be enough to help there.
Yeah, I think just having four main deck spell pierce does go a long way, and then we're embellishing that with two Fluster Storm in the sideboard. We can turn to our Veil of Summers if you want an additional kind of line of defense to back up those counter spells. And then three copies of Turn the Earth, which when you are shut off from classic graveyard hate like Relic of Progenitus, or it's weird to call Unlicensed Hearse classic graveyard hate when it's like the set before last, and that as well, I think, after Ledger Shredder, or maybe alongside it now, is the lasting impact from that set. You have to get a little bit more creative. So you can just turn to Leyline of the Void, like that's the nuclear option there. But that one has its own inconsistencies built in, and Turn the Earth is a nice way to not fully shut off Living End, and like the Plague Wind half of that is still in full effect, but you can at least stop them from flooding the board with power in the meantime, in a way that also gets through, you know, something like Grief, for example. And then it's another additional option you can have against like Burn, for instance. If we said a few weeks ago, we think that deck might be quite well positioned, and so this is just another line of defense in that matchup too.
Yeah, and I think that there's like another, there's some other like really subtle things. Like, for example, this list in the finals has four Fire Ice. That card is fairly strong in the matchup, just giving you another turn to set up in a lot of spots, which really, like, one of the big things it does is on the draw, it'll bridge you from turn two, tap their land so they can't cascade turn three, and that lets you Prismari Command to discard an Archon and maybe get out of that spot on turn three. So, like, there's a lot of little things. We'll get to another list that has some other stuff going on there for that matchup, but yeah, overall, not great, but you can try your hardest to push it back towards, you know, from 0% to, like, you know, 40%, maybe.
Yeah, and then we have two copies of Transmogrify as the redundancy for our creativity. It's just adding more access to that effect, even if it's, you know, it requires a different kind of setup and is more conditional in some ways. I guess one feature of this list to speak of is the one Unholy Heat in the deck, which there's not that much of a difference between this and like the fifth Lightning Bolt, or it's just another cheap piece of interaction. But in a world where Unholy Heat is the premium removal spell in the format, and this seems like if creativity is going to be one of the best decks, then having that clean answer to an Archon increases the importance of that card in the format as a whole, but also in the creativity mirror. You can imagine having access to that card, if Delirium is reliable-ish, might allow you to break serve in terms of, you know, killing an Archon and then you get to Archon back, or like you would think that that card in this deck would be a more natural fit than it is, but I guess just Lightning Bolt being like, I don't think Delirium is free-ish here the way it is in, you know, Murktide or Shadow, for example. Like, you do have to work for it, and so given that, maybe Lightning Bolt is the go-to first and foremost.
That, and also the damage from Lightning Bolt does add up. A lot of the grindier matchups can often come down to like an Archon trigger or two, plus some random dwarf tokens, plus their shocks and fetches, plus two Lightning Bolts or whatever, adding up to 20. So there is a significant upside there. And like you said, look at the card types. It's kind of tough to get to Delirium in this deck. It is really not free.
Yeah, you're almost relying on either Prismari Command and then jumping through hoops so that that's discarding some new card type, even if that might not be your natural choice anyway. Or I guess like you cast Fable, you get to pad your graveyard with a second mode, and then they feel somewhat obliged to kill the third chapter, and now you have an enchantment there too, so that gets you there. But you're not speed running towards Illyrium the way that you are in some of these other decks. And yeah, when your main creativity plant is shut off, you need some way to win the game. And between Fable and Dwarven Mind tokens in particular, and Renin 6, you can like nickel and dime them and then try to finish a job. And especially with Renin 6 building towards the ultimate, ultimating that with a handful of lands and just casting the same Lightning Bolt over and over is actually a somewhat realistic game plan if you need it to be.
Yeah, and that is another argument in favor of like the heavy counterspells, is just another thing to do when Renin 6 gets up to ultimate. Yeah, I mean, creativity is a very good deck. It's been winning a lot. There's a lot of like small angles it gets to take that make it more than just like a resolve a 4-mana sorcery deck, and these are some of them. The rest of this top four is basically the exact reverse of the finals. We have two Raghavan decks, two very different Raghavan decks, with one reasonably large aspect together. So there's, in fourth place, a very stock is it deck at this point, you know, all the things you'd expect to see, a bunch of channelers, a bit less Murktide than before. In third place, we have Soulstrong back with Shadow, but not really Grixis, just Rakdos Shadow.
Yeah, so this is a friend of the show, Soulstrong, back on his border, I suppose, with not Grixis Shadow, which is how he really put his name on the map, but Rakdos Shadow. And I guess the way you get here is if you like some of the disruptive elements of the Rakdos Scam or Rakdos Grief deck, but you don't like the actual Grief Fury combo component, and you just want to play just a more conventional Rakdos deck with, I guess, Death Shadow being his trademark card at this point, which is a little strange in this context, because in Grixis Shadow, it was almost the next best threat. And in contrast to Grixis Shadow circa like 2017, 2018, where you played that and it was the namesake of the deck and it was one of the only threats that you had, and that was one of the weak points of that strategy, was often you could just run out of threats, or if one threat was offline, you really had few ways to win the game, to where the deck was when it was dominating the format a few months ago, where you were a Ragavan and DRC deck first and foremost. Death Shadow was kind of along for the ride as the next best thing, and then with Ledger Shredder as well, well, now you had so many good threats to choose between that if you wanted to cut Shadow entirely, you probably could work it out of the deck. Here, that's even more the case, where you have 21 total creatures, counting the Death Shadows in this list. So you have the one-drop pair of DRC and Ragavan. You also have the four main deck Douthi Voidwalkers that we recognize from the Rakdos Scam list. And then Seasoned Pyromancer, one Croakzer, one Torak. So you could quite easily, I think, build this deck without Death Shadow, and perhaps should even, because look, at a glance, looking down this mana base, this does not seem like a great Death Shadow deck, and we don't have cards like Street Wraith to kind of grease the wheels there and accelerate it out. It's just another one-drop circa turn 4, turn 5, which is actually weirdly fitting with the theme of this episode, where Leyline Binding is another kind of one-drop that has the Serra Avenger text stapled onto it, if you like.
Yeah, the combo of Shadow and Douthi Voidwalker is kind of weird to me, because one of them is like a relatively inefficient threat with a bunch of like value versatility, and Shadow is just all rate. And I don't like, it feels like you're pushing your deck further up the curve by combining those two cards. The thing that stood out to me was both the Izzet deck and this Rakdos deck having multiple copies of main deck Blood Moon, which it feels like has become the trend for these decks the last couple of weeks. So this is sort of a reaction to Leyline Binding, especially as, you know, we'll get into this, but Leyline Binding has forced Izzet to really look for new ways to attack the matchup of like a generic deck with Leyline Binding that has a lot of colors versus Izzet. And Blood Moon is a good card against a deck with a lot of colors.
I think creativity is a big part of that too, where Blood Moon does enough against enough decks that it's always decent just as a baseline. And you think about some of the like red-green land destruction decks or mid-range decks we've seen in the past, where they were just a bunch of kind of medium on-rate threats backed up by Blood Moon, and that was kind of the main appeal. So Blood Moon as a tactic or as a strategy is always like waiting in the wings, ready to strike. And so whenever the format cycles around to the point of the best deck or the deck that people are targeting is weak to Blood Moon, well, now you can just pounce immediately with your Blood Moon deck. And with creativity, shutting off just their already highly fragile mana base, and we see Canister in Sunday's challenge with the Galaxy Brain move of sideboarding Abundant Growth just to, you know, preemptively give you a way to actually cast spells under a Blood Moon. But even with that, you know, if Dwarven Mine is shut off as a token creator and, you know, so many of their other spells are cut off, well, now even just to execute the creativity game plan, they're effectively a two-card combo deck of Fable plus creativity, and then that's a lot easier to break up at that point. And so it takes only this pretty minor investment to really cripple the creativity deck. And so when it does that, and also like looking at the finals, Blood Moon tends to be pretty good against Living End, pretty good against just most random stuff lurking around. And so when we're at the point where creativity is reliably two copies, three copies in almost every top eight, being a main deck Blood Moon deck seems like a great place to be.
Yeah, main deck especially. I think that there are basically, my experience with Blood Moon against creativity is that you can maneuver your early turns such that you deploy your non-red spells and maybe have a couple things back after they cast the Blood Moon. But like having to do that every single game of a match is really tough, especially like the games on the draw, it's really hard to do. So yeah, that all lines up for me.
Yeah, and then in fifth place with Engelsdorfer, we have another distinct shadow deck, this actually being blue-black shadow. So this is, to flog this dead horse once again, this is the Thoughtseize plus Motai region deck that I've been waiting for a long time. But here, I think Ledger Shredder moves the needle in terms of actually having enough threats, where with Grixis Shadow, because you have those red one drops, you're almost adding to this deep bench of threats that's already there. With Dimir Shadow, you go from really scratching your head trying to find that tertiary threat after Shadow and Murktide, and Ledger Shredder just slots in there fantastically. And so you have this nice suite of threats backed up by kind of what you'd expect. Thoughtseize and Inquisition over here, Counterspell, Archmage's Charm, Drowning the Lock over here, and then some Fatal Pushes and even a Stump Denial tying the room together in between.
Yeah, this deck does not do a lot of things on turn one, which is kind of an issue, but it does have a lot of the more powerful threats going late, which maybe, you know, we keep talking about these decks that are positioning longer. It does feel like the format has generally shifted towards playing longer games over the last month, not just, like, because of Leyline Binding or anything, just I think a lot of decks have found their solution to the four-color problem is, like, building in such a way that they can hang for like 9 turns with 4 color, but not 19, and hoping that somewhere in those 9 turns they get a good lineup. So you just have like a lot more matches where you aren't necessarily under a ton of pressure early because people undercutting 4 color has become less of a thing.
I also just don't know how much normal 4 color is a concern or a deck you have to worry about at this stage. Like you need a good creativity matchup, or you need that to be at least passable or fixable. But if you take the L against 4-color, I think that's okay. I think you can just take the L against 4-color.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, there is a copy of 4-color played by Pensur, someone who's written into the podcast, talks on the Discord. Previously a longtime Murktide player, recently converted to some 4-color dabbling. And there's still some like debates in that archetype about where it should land right now. But yeah, there's not a lot of it necessarily at the top of the metagame there as there was like 2 months ago.
Yeah, in seventh place we have a copy of Grinding Breach, and this is a weekend I think where the deck both continued to put up excellent results in paper. We had Ross Merriam I think getting second this time, not winning the whole thing, but losing a mirror in the finals of the I think the side event at the Legacy Pit tournament, and then at the face-to-face open in Montreal, Eduardo Sajglik wins with Breach in a top 8 that I think contained at least one other Breach deck. So the deck breaking through in paper and then starting, or has already broken through in paper, continuing to put up good numbers there, and then perhaps starting to break through online as well.
Yeah, I'll have to come back to that deck because the meta has changed so much since I last played it and see how I feel about it then. At the time, my thought was basically like, this is Urza Saga plus cards, and I think I've said that multiple times since then. I don't know if that is quite where I want to be at right now, but it does look like things like Dress Down and stuff have dropped away. I did hear rumors about Aspiring Spike playing with a Gruul Breach deck, and I think that was basically just like, I'd have to double check for the list, but Emery and Ledger Shredder are kind of the only blue cards. Most of the combo can be centered in red. So there may still be room for this deck to grow and, you know, alter exactly what's in it, maybe move to be like a red and six strategy as well.
Yeah, Iteration, another appealing blue card, but I think the main draw to Gruul is that you get to be mostly mono red just with this light splash for red and six. So your mana improves in that sense, and then red and six itself also helps to address any future mana based concerns. And then you have that combo that did so much good work last summer of Ren and Six with Urza Saga, and then you have Baseju now as another cherry on top there. And more generally, I think that if you doubt the utility of, let's say, Emery or Ledger Shredder or what have you, then Ren and Six is another way to kind of do a little bit of everything all at once and turn on Mox Amber at the same time, while just having perhaps the best card in Modern and one which, if depending on who you ask, should not get to remain in the format in your deck alongside everything else for good measure.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the list now that was posted by Spike recently. That I think that your comment about iteration is important. I really think that, I mean, I've talked about the Ledger Shredder Urza Saga thing too many times, where you just like, you're like, turn two Urza Saga Ledger Shredder, I'm never triggering this card, go. And, like, I don't think Emery is a very powerful Magic card. And depending on how good Engineer Explosives is, it's doesn't seem that important outside of adding Mox Ember mana. So I think there may be room to wiggle on the other blue cards.
Yeah, Emery, it looked so broken when it was spoiled and released, and given the surrounding context of this is a Throne of Eldraine card, the bar was set quite high there, and then it really underperformed initially, and then had this brief moment in the sun with, you know, the Simic Urza decks, where it actually did some pretty good work there. But it, I think by and large, over the, what is it, God, 3 years now since its release, I don't think it's lived up to the potential that so many people assigned it when it was first delivered to us.
Yeah, it's always like the ninth best card. It's the same thing as it's Frogmite, right? Like, it's just in the deck and it's there. It's like technically broken, but not the most important card. Like, it's not your Cranial Plating or your Great Furnace. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of a body that does something.
Finishing up on this Saturday challenge then, just outside the top eight, we have two more copies of Creativity, and then a few more four-color Omnath decks, so two copies of Amulet Titan, and our first hammer in 15th place in the hands of, who else? Happy Sandwich. And so it is interesting to look at, let's say, a week or two ago when it was Hammer versus Yawgmoth seemed to be one of the main stories of the format, and you have to look throughout basically the entire top 16 to find a single copy of one of those decks in these tournaments. So a nice reminder to always take each of these individual tournaments with a grain of salt, and you know, the full story is usually somewhat more layered and complex there. Let's move on then to this Sunday challenge, where, as we mentioned, I guess friend of the show or critical supporter of the show, Canister, put his money where his mouth is, and with his quite unique take on Creativity, cracked into this top eight here.
Yeah, this is very persist heavy. I had seen some lists that went to persist heavy builds that also moved into black for Shadow Prophecy as well. But this is just leaning on the four Fables and four Prismari commands to discard the Archon. The main deck here is very linear, and then it's really just those sideboard Abundant Growths that are really interesting as a way to push back against Blood Moon.
Yeah, this is not the last we will hear about Shadow Prophecy in Reanimator, but in the context of Creativity, it's you can see the appeal of the card, especially when you're finding your namesake is so important. At the same time, it's quite a clunky spell in a deck that already has that as its main weakness that's holding it back from even further domination, I would argue. So don't know if that's quite the right home for it. But yeah, this is, you know, Canister is a vocal critic of Transmogrify as the secondary cheat spell of choice. And so once you reach that conclusion, you really have nowhere else to go other than persist with, I guess, additional discard outlets like the fourth Prismari command as the backup plan there, which I don't know how reliable that is necessarily, but you do also, if you're on the draw, have the backup plan of, like, just cast turn two Renin 6 and keep upticking it, and that's going to get you to 8 cards in hand naturally the following turn, at which point you can discard Archon to hand size, and if you just have not needed to do anything in the game until that point, then maybe that's good enough.
Yeah, my issue with persist in these decks is always the same, where, like, you can either build your mana really skewed and play cards like Tainted Indulgence, in which case your Dwarven Mines start looking really bad, or you can have it, like, not really well supported, which this list is, like, sort of in that ballpark. I don't know, I like I said, I mentioned the Living End matchup. I've been willing to draw and discard to hand size, so maybe that's good enough.
Mm-hmm. One interesting thing that shows up in the sideboard here is Canister has a single copy of Ashen Rider, and one of the other Creativity lists that we touched upon had an Iona, Shield of Emira, in the sideboard too. So when you only have access to one copy of that effect, are there matchups where you are completely de-emphasizing the Archon plan and thinking, okay, if I have this one Iona, I brought that in, I'm planning to Creativity, or I guess in that list, Transmogrify into that every single time, and that's going to ice the game, and that's more reliable than just one Archon, which may or may not be good enough? Or is it you're leaving the Archons in the deck, or some of them, boarding in the Iona, and if you happen to hit Yahtzee and turn that one up, great, and if not, maybe you can still rely on the Archons to get the job done?
I think it's more the second, especially when you talk about a heavy persist list where you are able to, like, sort of up your hit count for, like, you know, the other downside being that you only have four Archons in your main deck to draw and discard. Well, if you boost that a little bit, it helps a lot. And I've seen discussion of, like, Sundering Titan in that spot as well. That's the one draw to, like, these over Iona, is that it actually, like, these boost your persist count and Iona doesn't.
Yeah. In the rest of this top eight, we have a friend of the show and combat enthusiast, Xenowan, on the Jeskai Beach deck. So yet another not in that column. We have Zerg on Blackwing New Orgmoth. So having a little bit of a better challenge over here. And then maybe the story of this tournament is Merfolk copying the top eight in the hands of MD91 and then another in the top 16 as well.
Yeah, I think that that deck has benefited a lot from a downtick in the... You know, we talked about the Rakdos Shadow deck. I think there's been a divergence in the Rakdos decks in general that means less Fury, which is kind of the biggest problem for this deck. It is noticeably more powerful against the spread, so that's a good thing for it. The bad matchups did not get better, but it's good enough against the rest that Merfolk is better positioned now than it was a month ago because of Dominaria United. I actually think the bigger story might be fifth place, which is the return of Dredge. And that wasn't just here. We'll get to paper results, but a Dredge top eighted the LMS Grand Open as well. This, you know, there is not a lot of hard graveyard hate. And as people move away from Counterspell, this like two drop spell heavy Dredge becomes less and less afraid of just running out its turn two Cathartic Reunion after mulling to four. It is a powerful exploit deck. It's extremely in on the exploit angle, but it's there.
Yeah, I think my position with this deck is I want to own a copy and like have some reps in with it, and so be ready to bring it out on a specific weekend to exploit this hard metagame read, but I don't plan on doing that anytime soon. And so we mentioned the seemingly surprising success of Yawgmoth at a time when it felt like the format at large seemed like it should be quite hostile towards it, with, you know, the main deck Douthi Voidwalker and Fury deck and a lot of these other developments. And that's kind of how I feel about Dredge. It's like I almost in reverse. I can see the argument for Dredge looking at some of these shadow decks and Murktai decks and so on, and the creativity list where, like, game one, I think you're pretty solidly favored against them, and then they don't even have access to the good graveyard hate if they want it. But I think the deck just fundamentally isn't that consistent, and we actually had it in the Modern Sea at a team tournament this weekend, where even in good matchups where they didn't have much hate or where it felt like the conditions should be right to exploit that, the deck just died to itself too often, and I think that would scare me off really embracing it. Although 7-0 in the Swiss here for Nick Norman, and then falling in the top eight, so like a great run and a data point worth noting, but I don't know. I think this is very much a one-hit wonder here.
The four gemstone caverns didn't give away the luck aspect of the deck. For what it's worth, I think the deck is relatively consistent in the sense that you just have to accept that a large number of your games are literally just four-card hands where you just present the cards in your hand, and if that fails, you're just done. You don't have these, like, classic Dredge with, like, Mull the Five in your hand would be, like, Land, Looting, Dredge Card, Reunion, and, like, a blank. And that was a hand that could fire through two pieces of interaction. This deck doesn't have that luxury.
Yeah, to continue the Yawgmoth comparison, I suppose, you don't have that, like, scrappy creature beatdown aspect where, well, I can't comment you anytime soon, but maybe this Strangaroo Geist and this Grist or something will win some kind of fair game by themselves. That can happen in Dredge sometimes, and it's almost memorable when it does because of how difficult that feels, just like manually closing the game out with a Narco Amoeba and a hard cast prize amalgam or something, but you really don't have that resiliency in the same way. And so yeah, sometimes you feel like you should win the game or should win the matchup, but you mull to five and your one enabler gets Thoughtseize, and then you just flounder around and don't do anything, or your opponent, who didn't show up with that much hate, did actually draw their unlicensed hearse or something in this game, and your hand lines up in such a way where that is actually good enough to beat you by itself. So I don't know. I, for as much as in the past on here I have said that, oh, it seems like the time is right for Dredge to return, having seen that in action and being burned by that, I'm a little more skeptical than I used to be.
Yeah, it's some of the same feel as, like, Burn, where, like, sometimes your cards just don't come together, and that's what happens. Yeah, you are sacrificing a lot of agency to play this deck, but it does offer at least something in return. I think that the other story of this event, you know, we got through most of the top eight here with I think that, like, just outside the top eight might be almost more interesting than this extreme spread here, you know. So we talked, you know, Dredge and Merfolk. Well, in ninth, and actually in top eight, like fifth or sixth place of the other challenge. We had the Scion of Draco, Your Rhinos, Five Color Rhinos, where like Scion of Draco has just become part of the deck with Leyline Binding as just a piece of action you can play on turn two in your Rhinos deck, which I think is like a kind of interesting development. Not sure how great it is, but let's take a look at this 10th place list, because it almost looks like someone registered their Pioneer deck for the Modern challenge.
Yeah, this is mono white humans, and no like slight splash of a fetch land here and a canopy land here or something. This is just straight mono white humans with, I guess, once you frame it in those terms, kind of the cards that you would expect. So like Aether Vial, Champion of the Parish, Espen Sentinel, Thalia's Lieutenant, like nothing too unusual there. But I guess if you are strictly mono white, you have to make up the number somehow. And so we do see like two giant killers in the main deck here, and two Guardian of New Bernardia, this like seasoned Hallowblade impersonator from Dominaria United. So I guess another card from that set making waves, although possibly not too many.
Yeah, well, so I have actually been really impressed with Anointed Peacekeeper. I've run into some of the like bigger, like this is like kind of a much more lean Death and Taxes style deck. I've run into some of the bigger ones lately, and Peacekeeper has been relatively obnoxious in terms of what it does. So like, you like let's just kind of work through. So this is the sort of like Elite Spellbinder lookalike. It's the 3/3 vigilance for 3 that you look at their hand and then name a card, and it makes spells your opponents cast with that name cost 2 more. So I've been gotten just by like having multiples of the same card in a way that Spellbinder would just completely fail. And then it shuts off activated abilities unless they're mana abilities, which I've just been gotten by like, oh, I have 2 fetch lands in my hand for my land drop, and like I'm just gonna miss my 3rd or 4th land drop because this card makes my fetch land cost 2.
I will say, looking at the art for Anointed Peacekeeper, does not look like Paolo whatsoever, but everything else you said is on the money, and I think makes a good argument for this card, which even in mono white humans, like with both of those restrictions, there are a lot of good 3-drops you can play. And so the fact that this one is making the cut over, you know, something like Adeline or Elite Spellbinder, which may be the natural comparison, does say a lot, I think.
Yeah, I really was looking for the Adelines in this deck, but sadly, it looks like Ranger Captain of Eos, which is definitely a better card, is showing up instead. And that does explain some of the giant killers. Extraction Specialist also making the cut, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is a 4 Extraction Specialist deck, and once you have 4 of those, 4 Peacekeepers and 4 Rangers, you kind of run out of room for any additional 3-drops, especially when, with those Ranger Captains, you want to add to that toolbox somehow, which certainly explains at least the first Giant Killer, if not the second one. But one other interesting feature of this deck is 4 main deck Cathar Commando. So this is just a neat card for a human strategy in general, good against, you know, the card Urza Saga, or Hammer has been having a good few weeks, so nice to have some main deck interaction there. But specifically with Extraction Specialist, like if this is a matchup where you would want to draw several Cathar Commandos or have access to that effect multiple times, Extraction Specialist really lets you do that.
Yeah, I mean, that card is also just like a very powerful card. The rate on that card is way better than it looks across the board. Like, not even counting like, oh, I get to loop back Cathar Commando, just like most of the ones and twos in this deck do something even if they can't attack and block. With like most of Athalia is from the static ability, most of Athalia's Lieutenant is from the activated ability, most of a Giant Killer is from the activated ability. So like that card is just getting a lot of value along the way, and I think that is just like picking up those 2-for-1 values every single turn is kind of a really important part of Modern right now. Like I was saying this with like decks, you know, deciding to play a slower game, a lot of that comes in the factor of like 8 million good creatures in Modern having a good enter the battlefield. Like I was, you know, Rakdos, for example, with Grief and Fury. An Extraction Specialist isn't quite on the level of those cards, but it's playing the same game.
I do finally want to highlight this sideboard, which has the usual caveat of I'm a mono white deck, I have to fill this out somehow, but 3 Hallowed Moonlight, a card which we've seen pick up across the board, really, ranging from, you know, blue eye control to 4 color to really any deck that can cast that card, as this all-purpose response to Creativity over here and Living End over here and Rhinos as well, because it doesn't specify non-token or anything. So this is a hard counter that draws a card to a Crashing Footfalls, or pretty good against Yawgmoth as well, like hard countering Call of Calling or Eldritch Evolution while fizzling an Undying trigger. So lots of applications for this card wherever you look, and so would not be surprised to see that one stick around for as long as creativity remains on top of the format. But more importantly here, we have two Aureate Champion and the 4/4 copies of Sanctifier on Vex. So really putting the hurt on the Black Red Scam deck and anything in that space, the two different Shadow decks that also showed up this weekend, and Sanctifier in particular. Like if anyone does try to roll the dice and show up with Dredge, anyone who showed up with Sanctifier is going to be very pleased about that development.
Yeah, this card is really looped back around to being really good. Obviously, very powerful against Rakdos Scam, but like all the other Rakdos offshoot decks, and just like a lot of other random red decks, that this card is very functional against. After a while where it was looking kind of like, this card isn't the card you want against Ledger Shredder, and is it? It's really interesting to see how Sanctifier kind of loops around every few months between like Grizzly Bear that can't be targeted, like Hexproof 2/2 for 2, to like actually 2-mana unkillable shuts off your opponent's entire deck.
Yeah, it's the kind of card which, if you have your hammer box or your humans box, where you just have the 100 or so playable cards that could, in theory, go in the deck at some point, it should have like 4 Sanctifiers in it, and those will lie dormant for 6 months at a time. But when they're good, they're really good. Those will be the first thing you reach for when constructing your sideboard.
Yeah. Anything else from this top 32, or do you want to jump over to the LMS over in Europe?
Yeah, let's do a quick roundup of the various in-person events. So we'll start with the LMS in Amsterdam, the Grand Open qualifier, but not nearly as grand as I think they were hoping for, given the low turnout and the pretty shambolic organization from everything I was told.
Yeah, you know, one of the growing pains of tournament series with TOs that have not had a long history of running events is sometimes things go wrong. Even with like very established TOs, things go wrong. I don't know. I could go on and on about this and how like this has been something that has been boiling for more, like not even like this year, but like probably 13 years worth of this cycle coming around. But yeah, not surprised. I mean, the event ran. It's fine. You know, nothing just like abruptly didn't happen or whatever happened at the ball pit in Vegas that one time. But, you know, it was an event that was less attended than people expected.
Yeah, given all of the other tournament mishaps that we're hearing about recently, I think one of the takeaways, honestly, is it is really hard to run a big Magic tournament these days, maybe harder than it has been in a long time. And so even experienced TOs who are trying to put these events together in good faith are going to struggle to do that sometimes. And then when on top of that you have a TO who is gaining this infamous reputation for poor communication and making a lot of unforced errors on top of that, then this is what you get as a result, unfortunately. But these top 8 decklists, at the least, do make for some interesting reading.
Yeah, so a lot of Yawgmoth heroes. That 3 Yawgmoth decks in this top 8?
Yes.
Which is, you know, there's not a ton going on in most of them. There is one that sideboards into a giant pile of Ivy Lane Denizens and Scurry Oaks, which is kind of adorable, and has Dothi Voidwalkers for the mirror, but most of the others are fairly stock.
Yeah, notably the winner here actually is Oscar Christensen, one of the more under-the-radar Magic pros from the tail end of the old organized play system, but he's someone who in recent months in Modern has been playing these kind of off-the-wall decks to very good results. So he won some other fairly large European tournament with the Prismatron deck back when that was briefly in vogue, and has been jumping around a little bit and putting up yet another W here with Yawgmoth this time. So always fun to see where he ends up. And then, as you mentioned, 2 other copies of Yawgmoth in the top 8, as well as the copy of Dredge that we mentioned, which this one is a little different, a bit of a heavier blue focus with Tomb Scour in the main deck, and this player, Baz Devan, associated with one of the more interesting moments of the weekend, as reported by Frank Carson, where thanks to Gemstone Caverns plus Huerta, he was able to destroy the ley line on his opponent's upkeep before the Flusterstorm backup in their opening hand would have been able to protect it. So playing through hate in the most impressive way there. And then going down the rest of this, for completeness sake, we have Hardened Scales. So always good to see that one here. And whenever you look at a Hardened Scales list, it's the mana base is just like a bunch of these random lands that could not possibly show up in any other context. And then a bunch of these like random Urza Saga targets that you're never sure if it's actually worth the slot there, but we have the one Bodding Jar, the one Pithy Needle, the Springleaf Drum, the Animation Module, and a Shadow Spear, two copies of the Ozolith. Like, I don't know how much any of these are actually doing for you, but, you know, just take your pick and have fun with it, I suppose.
Yeah, the Ozoliths are obviously great. I'm shocked that there's not just more modules. I do absolutely adore the one Gemstone Caverns in this deck.
Yes.
Hardened Scales is... notably a deck that starts the game on 2 mana a lot better than 1. So seeing that card show up as a way to, on the draw, start the game on 2 mana, really love that.
Yeah, I think Gemstone Caverns is a really underexplored card in general, and specifically that pairing of Gemstone Caverns plus Urza Saga, where you can play your turn 1 Saga, start activating on turn 2, getting full value out of it if you had a Gemstone Caverns alongside it. That is a really phenomenal opening, but not one that many decks can just realistically support in their mana base. But Hardened Scales is one of those, and so really nice to see that one copy of Caverns showing up there.
Yep. A 5-color creativity deck with Teferi, without any of, like, you know, just a very stock Teferi list, as you can imagine. With Leyline Binding, well,
this one also has a creature in the sideboard, but maybe not one that you would expect.
Yeah, it's a black cat, which I believe is like some sort of meme. I think it may have actually started with Saito a number of years ago and carried on from there, but I could be wrong.
Which, in light of recent news, maybe carries a whole different connotation around bad luck or bad opens or what have you.
Yeah, moving along to an actual deck list, we have Wild Nacatl showing up in a top 8 once again next to Nishoba Brawler. This is the Domain Zoo deck that has picked up in recent weeks. Again, this is the kind of thing where I just run into these decks playing the like worst possible matchup and get the worst impression of them to start. It is noticeable how good and layered the burn is when you have multiple 2-mana 5/5s. Like, Tribal Flames and Bolt go a long way if your opponent even takes a single hit for 5. That said, there is a reason that, like, Wild Nacatl and 2-mana 5/5s are not the most exciting things ever. I would also sort of weirdly tie this deck's success to Urza Saga, because if there's too much Saga, you're also going to get hit by the dressdowns.
Yeah, this is an actual factual Domain deck. 15 cards with the word Domain on them, and Wild Nacatl as an honorary Domain card as well, backed up by... Oh, wait, no, Tribal Flames. I had 19 Domain cards, excuse me. Backed up by Summon Denial, which when you have Territorial Carvu, Son of Draco, and a Shoba Brawler, all those creatures that mostly are going to start with 4 or more power, like, that is just a 1-mana hard counterspell a lot of the time, which, again, in a format where one of these challenges had Living End versus Creativity in the finals, and you can find good targets for Summon Denial wherever you look. And then, yeah, Leyline Binding as a premium removal spell in this deck, and the rare ability to count up damage in increments of 3 or 5, which gets you up to 20 pretty quickly if you have any burn experience.
Yeah, yeah. I will just say that when you are playing against this deck, you do need to answer their threats immediately, but you may actually want to preserve your life total over deploying your own threats in a lot of spots. Pushing a turn ahead with a fetch is less important, or with a shock is less important than maybe saving that 2 life and continuing on, because most of their stuff is fairly 1-for-1.
Yeah, the dress down interactions that you mentioned kind of vary between the different creatures here. So Wild Nacatl will get shrunk down to a 1-1 and be noticeably more mild. Ragavan, still could not tell you from memory how the dash Ragavan versus dress down thing works exactly, but I guess memorize that one if you're planning to play with this deck. And then Territorial Carvu, this is the one which really gets punished hard, where it just dies outright to a dress down. Nishoba Brawler, the new kid on the block, that one will just become an 0-3 for the duration of the turn, which is not ideal, but it at least will stick around. And then Son of Draco will be a 4-4 but lose flying, and then your other creatures will lose whatever abilities it bestowed on them in turn as well.
Yeah, so the Ragavan, at least according to Magic Online, and it may be timestamp related, it loses haste and then gets picked up at the end of the turn. The delayed trigger is not an ability. But
that sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, so that has come up for me. It is rare, but yeah, it's really just like the dress down versus Kabu interaction, and the fact that it's going to have sideways utility against the rest of the deck, that's kind of an issue.
So unless there's anything else from these results or any of the others, let's start talking about a card which is, it shows up here, it shows up pretty much everywhere at this point, and that's Leyline Binding, which is the runaway breakout star from Dominaria United at this point.
Yeah, and I think it just really is a question of how close to the Modern Horizons 2 removal can you get in a standard set, and this card gets relatively close, which I think, let's just start off with the question of, like, Unholy Heat and Prismatic Ending are so good because they're one mana removal, and, like, does Leyline Binding actually count as one mana removal?
So there are times where you really feel the fact that it's not hard one mana removal. So On the Draw against Ragavan would be the perfect example, right? Or sometimes you really wish you could Bolt the Bird or Ending the Bird, and you can't Leyline Binding the Bird unless you're on the play and you have the right sequence of fetch lands and so on. So there are definitely times where the fact that this is a fake one mana card and not an actual one mana card really does come back to bite you. On the other hand, in how many of those situations would the card that you're replacing with binding actually fix that issue instead? Because you could take your four color Traverse deck and, like, start cutting away at Unholy Heats to fit in Leyline Bindings, but for my money, a card like Unholy Heat is part of the draw to that entire package in the first place, and if you're adding Leyline Binding in that context, it's going to be on top of that in a few copies, or you're going to find your cards elsewhere, maybe in some of those, like, dress down flex slots, for example. So you definitely feel the weaknesses of this card when they come up, but the consolation is that, well, it's not like you punish yourself by putting Binding in your deck, because, you know, no alternative deck building choice really would have bailed you out of that situation.
Yeah, well, I think that this is an important thing to, like, bring up, which is, I know that one of the lists that top-aided a challenge, I want to say last weekend, just completely cut the heats or bolt slots for bindings. That, I think, is not something you want to do. I think that you need to mix it up so that you have those answers to Ragavan. Like, if you just look at your hand and there's not an ending and they go Ragavan on one, the game is just going to be a nightmare for you.
Yeah, and to me, that is part of the appeal of Unholy Heat in the context of the classic four-color Traverse deck, which is that Prismatic Ending sometimes is a good answer to Ragavan, and if you're on the play and you have Ren and Six and they expose it on turn one, then you get to punish them in due course for that. But sometimes none of your other removal really lines up that well against it. And this is, you know, one of Canis's weekly polls on Twitter, which you can never quite tell if they're meant to spark discussion or just spark enjoyment for himself. But one of them, I think, made a very salient point, which is that, you know, you really feel the loss of the card, at least, and potentially the game, if you have the need to pitch cards to Solitude on a turn one Ragavan, or, you know, Path to Exile has really fallen out of favor in Modern at large, but if one of the arguments against that card is that you can't really afford to give them a resource back by hitting their turn one threat, then going down a card to, you know, break the emergency glass on a Solitude or a Fury sometimes gets you in a kind of equivalent spot. And so having something which just, no question asked, kill a Ragavan, that is a really big deal. And so binding is not that, but outside of Unholy Heat, like, what else could be, really? I guess you could go back to good old-fashioned Lightning Bolt, but then that has its own pretty stark weaknesses, which become apparent when they show up. So there's not a good answer to that question, and so that specific trade-off when it comes to Leyline Binding isn't as acute as maybe it seems at first glance, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I guess we can get into this, but I think that I'm basically arguing for that, like, if you build your deck like that, you still want, like, two heats and three bindings and not just, like, max out four bindings or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the Traverse list, it seemed like binding would not be a natural fit there because, first of all, finding a spot for this off-color Triome, if you like, or what have you, in the mana base or an additional Triome or something is non-trivial because these decks already have an artificially low land count, and this list in particular with Traverse has fewer lands and has more interest in playing like a Baseju or an Odawara or something as a utility land. And so, firstly, that can mess with your Leyline Binding sequencing or your math sometimes. Like, if your draw is even fetch land for Triome plus Baseju, well, that binding is still costing three mana unless you can find that additional land to get the full discount. And then on top of that, it's, you know, in that list, there's a big incentive to have removal spells which go to your graveyard and give you that additional card type to fuel future spells that have Delirium. And so Leyline Binding having this weakness in terms of its conditionality and its setup, and then not contributing to delirium, and then having the weaknesses to cards like Besaidu and Teferi and so on, which I'm sure we'll come back to in due course, all of those factors, I think, really mitigate against it. That being said, in the showcase that happened recently, Stefan Schütz, Mental Misstep, lodged yet another top 8 with just 4-color Traverse with 3 copies of Leyline Binding in the main deck, and just embracing some of those contradictions, I suppose, and saying, I think this effect is good enough that I want some access to it anyway.
Well, I think that there's another part here that is kind of weird to talk about, which is that Leyline Binding is good with other 1-drops, like, not just because it creates these turns where you just have these really modular, like, play a 1-drop, play a 1-drop, play a 2-drop or 3-drop, and, like, just spend all your mana really efficiently, but because, like, you're artificially adding more, pseudo 1-drops to your deck in needing to fetch a black Triome a lot of the times. So, like, you often have, like, the situations I'm thinking of are, like, you draw a... I don't know what the, like, appropriate land to describe here is, but there's, like, a lot of times where you don't have the idealized, like, fetch my Triome on one, and then, like, have the right fetch land for my Shock on two. Like, this whole stuff, or, like, maybe you just have to Prismatic Ending on one and kill something, and then you want to fetch your Triome on two, and, like, it just... stuff doesn't line up 100% right, and you're left with a lot of spots where, like, if you have a lot of 1-drops, you can avoid leaving mana on the floor when that happens.
Yeah, there is some debate over whether you actually need that fifth land type baked into a Triome somewhere. So in a deck like this, could you get away with just running the mana base you had before, maybe with some other cosmetic adjustments, but not needing that Zagoth Triome or what have you? I think the answer is you really do need the possibility of binding costing one. I think that difference between one mana and two mana often is game-changing, and I don't think binding is a modern quality card as consistently as it needs to be if the minimum it can cost is 2 mana.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is part of why it was such a natural fit for the creativity decks, where a lot of their curve, like, the creativity deck's curve is largely, like, 1 and 3, unless you have a Ren and 6, right? You don't, if you, like, cut the Explorer for Leyline Bindings, which a lot of lists were doing, you don't really need 2 mana for anything, so you just have this natural slot of, like, well, if I don't need a spell on one, I'll get a Triome. If I cast a spell on one, I'll just get the Triome the next turn, and everything works out. Which, maybe this is just a good time to talk about, like, how the Triomes and fetching work, because that's just, like, a really tricky part of this card.
Yeah, in the context of creativity, I think there is still this subtle drawback there, where one reason your curve is structured that way is so that you need to have Dwarven Miners as an integral part of your mana base, but most creativity lists just don't run that many lands, and so there will be draws where one of your few lands is a Dwarven Mine, and you just need to find some spot to work that into your development. And the problem with Leyline Binding in that context is if one of your first two lands is a Dwarven Mine, it is really difficult to cast a cheap Leyline Binding anytime soon, because you have this mountain, and then it's not even like, okay, well, Dwarven Mine is a mountain, and I'm going to fetch a Sparrow's Headquarters or something, because you need all of your lands to be mountains, in part because of Dwarven Mine. And so there will be awkward draws where, you know, having this Dwarven Mine or having this Leyline Binding, their respective awkwardnesses, like, compound on each other, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that bridges nicely into one of the points I wanted to bring up about building these mana bases, which is, I think a lot of people have not appropriately readjusted their, like, Shock and Fetch calibrations to playing all these Triumphs for Leyline Bindings. And this is something, like, dating back to the old Domain Zoo days of, like, the 2000s, where it's very easy to create these idealized situations where every land you draw is a fetch land, but when you draw, like, your Dwarven Mine or, like, a basic Plains, just, like, a hand that has, like, a random Shock land or something like that, like, you need to be set up such that you should be thinking about, like, well, what fetches am I playing in the context of I am going to draw one of these duels in a lot of spots. How does this fetch get me out of this best to set up for Leyline Binding and casting my spells? And I don't think a lot of decks are necessarily doing that. It's not just, like, I don't know, a lot of decks have, like, I think there was a list that had, like, an Indatha Triome, a Rafine's Triome, and, like, a Jund Triome. I don't even know what the name is. A Ziator's Proving Ground. And, like, stuff like that is just not how you necessarily end up with a functional, like, you can't have, I don't think you can have a Zeotaurus Proving Ground and a Flooded Strand in your deck and, like, honestly say, like, that is how I'm going to have good mana. I think you have to, like, really think about what the combos are there and how things work when you draw cards that are, like, when you draw lands that are not just fetch lands every turn of the game. Unless you just want to play, you know, 84 cards in your Yorian deck and add another 4 fetches so that you do draw fetches.
Yeah, the next level Ben Rubin, I suppose. But yeah, this is a very familiar issue to anyone who has played the various 4-color Omnath decks, where you'll have these hands where, in theory, you have enough fetch lands and enough lands that bridge the gap between your different colors that you can mostly stitch something together, and often Abundant Growth is doing a lot of heavy lifting there, but you do still have these hands where you have, like, Icefang Coadal, Expressive Iteration, Counterspell, and Basic Planes, which just literally does nothing for you. It may as well just be a waste at that point. And so you want to minimize those scenarios as much as you can, but Leyline Binding, on top of all of these other pressures on your mana base, really forces you to think about not just which lands are in your deck, but then how you sequence the combination of lands that you draw and whether you've built your deck in a way that actually enables you to do that. So, for example, if you're working towards a one mana Leyline Binding, then often the sequence you're going to want to go with is, let's say, fetch a white Triome on turn one, and then on turn two, I'm going to fetch another Triome or a tap shock land that covers the other two basic land types, and that frees up the white mana on my one untapped land now to cast the Binding for one mana. And so everything kind of works out perfectly. But then, you know, if you get into spots where you have to fetch the Zeotaurus Proving Ground or whatever this other off-color Triome is, and now, okay, I have to fetch this other land, but now I don't have the white mana when I need it, or now my Binding is costing two instead of one, and that means I can't double spell this turn, which means I then can't double spell next turn. It's really easy for any of these minor inconsistencies to kind of cascade into each other, especially when, if you're putting Binding into your deck, for as much as I'm saying it's not at the expense of other interaction, you can't really play, like, 4 Solitude, 4 Prismatic Ending, 4 Unholy Heat, 4 Leyline Binding. Like, something has to give somewhere. So the Mental Misstep list, for example, has 3 Unholy Heat and 3 Binding, which feels like a decent compromise to me. But if your expected development relies on, okay, I'm going to have a 1 mana removal spell at this time frame in this game, then you need that card to actually cost 1 mana and to actually remove the spell. And if your Binding just costs 2 or 3 in a way that is an avoidable mistake, then you really are going to get punished for that, and justifiably so.
Yeah, this is another spot where, like, you talk about, like, oh, well, you can just, like, sort of overload on the one random removal. Like, another drawback here is that the thing that might solve this is, you know, I jokingly said play 84 cards, but playing more lands does actually make it so that Binding has more valuable combinations. But when you do that, you suddenly open yourself up to these hands when you overload on removal that are just, like, spot removal, spot removal, spot removal, 4 lands, none of my 2-for-1s, I'm just going to fall apart when my opponent casts Expressive Iteration. So there is actually a lot of, like, tension pulling your numbers in spots like that.
Yeah, so to give a worked example, when I was putting together that 80-card Glimpse deck that I got second in the challenge with, I had the idea to play this deck and to add Binding not long before the challenge started. And so when I was hastily compiling my mana base, I had to, on the fly, work out, okay, which combination of Triomes plus Shock Lands are going to let me cast all my spells and also cast Binding for one mana? And then how does that interact with, you know, the specific color requirements on, like, turn two Wave Sifter, for example? And so what I settled upon was, if I have Endatha Triome, so this is the Abzan Triome, which, if you don't know that, it's white, black, green, plus Steam Rents, then what that lets me do is it casts Wave Sifter on 2, it lets me fetch for my Triome on 1, and then cast my Binding on 2 while fetching for my Steam Rents or for my other Triome or something else, and then that combination of 2 lands with any third land casts any of my Cascade spells, whether it's Violent Outburst or Shardless Agent or Ardent Plea. And so that seemed like the right basic combination of lands to have in the deck, which couldn't really afford to just have a smattering of other Triomes, given that, well, I'm a 4 Colony Garden deck, so that's a lot of tap lands that are already present in my mana base, or I want to have some number of Cavern of Souls in here, and so, you know, that's going to be the best land in my deck sometimes, the worst land in my deck at other points, and so there are often a lot of these competing constraints that are, like, tugging you in different directions, and adding this additional layer of I need these specific land combinations at this specific time. I think it's an interesting puzzle, but it's also not a trivial one. And you can't, it, like, if you half-ass it, then you're going to get to round 8 in a tournament where suddenly you can't fetch the exact combination you need, and you're just going to lose a game which you probably could or should have won otherwise.
Yeah, I think that in there, the Wave Sifter thing was a good point to bring up, which is, like, there is sort of a reason why the stock combo I've seen in a lot of decks is fetching Steam Vents and Endatha Triome. It's because very few of those decks have white-green cards or blue-red cards, because, like, black... I'm going to discount black. Like, black is just, like, not the main color in most of these. Ideally, your, like, perfect fetch lineup and shock lineup should be such that it doesn't overlap with your multicolor cards. So, like, a Zeotora's Proving Grounds in your Red and Six deck means that a lot of your hands, if you just draw Hollowed Fountain or the Proving Grounds or whatever, aren't going to be able to cast Ren and Six on two and have the full domain set up. So that is something you really should be watching out for when sort of imagining what your pairings are. You should be looking more to, like, Zagoth Triome and a Sacred Foundry in that spot or something like that.
Yeah, and that first setup of the Absan Triome and Steam Rents would not work in this four-color Traverse deck, for example, because that Endatha Triome doesn't cast a spread of iteration. It doesn't cast Counterspell. And so those are basic constraints which are going to inform your distribution of combinations for Leyline Binding. I think also, especially when the Omnath colors, even if Omnath is not in the deck itself, like, that is the baseline for these decks a lot of the time, and you kind of graph the fifth color in there either just for Leyline Binding, or maybe you, like in the Bring to Light decks, maybe you have the one Unmoored Ego or the ability to hardcast Valkyrie or Tibalt or something. But by and large, if you're starting with the Omnath colors and then smuggling this fifth color in, you want that swamp to be ideally on a Triome instead of a shock land, because if you can fold it into a land which is also doing enough heavy lifting otherwise, then you don't end up in these spots where you have, like, this watery grave that's effectively a painful island, and then that in turn is causing issues if, like, that can't cast your endurance or something.
Yeah, that came up with, I think it was Melton's Scapeshift list that had a Overgrown Tomb as a black fetch, like a black shock land, and that was kind of obnoxious because not only was, like, just a forest not the most exciting thing in that deck, even though it, like, did line up for Ren and Six, that was, like, two of the color sources for Soul, but, like, also not a good land. Like, you could easily draw, like, a Boseiju and an Overgrown Tomb and not cast your Omnath. That was kind of obnoxious when I was playing that deck.
Yeah, and likewise in the Glimpse deck, where you have Colony Garden just as a green source, you can't have too many lands that don't produce good colors other than green. And so even though I think Absan Triome plus Steam Vents was the right starting combination there, it did have a drawback where sometimes you would have, like, Endatha Triome with Colony Garden. And even though a Triome in theory is, like, this really good fixing land, in practice it wasn't actually giving you the right spread of colors you needed in that situation.
Yeah, I think that the Rhinos list do a really good job of that coverage with their fetch, where, like, they specifically, it is, which fetch was it? It was, I seem to remember, like, the exact, I'm trying to remember the exact list off the top of my head, and I should be able to pull it up, but, you want your shock to be Steam Vents. Like, that's where the Endatha Triome Steam Vents thing comes up. Or, like, that's why Raugrin Triome is so good in those decks, is because any green land combines with that to be able to cast either of your cascade spells, because they are green blue or green red. So you really want your blue and red paired on that secondary land without the green. So yeah, that's kind of like where that Endatha Triome Steam Vent setup is really at its best.
Yeah, the Rhinos deck, I don't know if Leyline Binding is at its best in terms of function in that deck, or if it actually does, if it addresses the problems that a card like that is intended to fix. But I think that the Rhino's deck is maybe the best deck for accommodating binding into its mana base, because the constraints that Cascade puts upon your deck means that you don't have all of these one drops in different colors you're trying to stretch between at the same time. And if you're starting your curve on turn two in a lot of games, well, that gives you a lot more leeway to spend turn one fetching a Triome and then developing your mana base as you see fit from there.
Yeah, I mean, you want to just jump into some of the decks and talk through, like, the role of binding in there before we start talking about some specific card interactions? Because I guess Rhinos is a really good place to start. Because, that, like you said, that is sort of like the most effortless natural fit, because you're just looking for cards that are cheap interaction. It is a good way to clear out many of the sideboard hate cards. The Rhino's plan just like naturally lends itself to that. My experience with your Rhinos was mixed in that, like, it felt like a lot of the last 10 to 12 spells in the deck were kind of sketchy. Like, the Solitudes were not super impressive, even if, like, there's not, like, a huge cost to just adding Ardent Pleas to your deck or whatever, and it almost makes it better because you just don't draw footfalls that much. I think the deck, as it was built, was struggling. It felt the last slots, but that feels fixable. Like, you were literally just taking five colors of cards and putting them together. And Binding was really good in that deck.
Yeah, my experience with your Rhinos was, I actually did feel the diminishing returns of having too many pitch cards past a certain point, where even though part of the appeal is that Crashing Footfalls is such a good singular threat that you can just spend a card, like a Cascade spell, on that, and then throw all of your other cards away, maybe even like two for one in yourself to trade off with their cards, because your pair of Rhinos is going to get across the finish line. In practice, what I found was, unless I could Cascade quickly and back that up with the right interaction, often I would have to, like, a pitch cast Fury on this, or Solitude on this, and now I'm Force Negationing here, and trading one for one with a Leyline Binding over here, and now I just don't have any actual resources left, and I can't do my thing, and maybe I can, like, crawl my way towards hard casting Omnath, and then that will beget something else, but it just felt like a lot of work for games which seemed like they should be easier than they were, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I had the reverse issue, where I just, like, had, like, a Fury, a Solitude, and a Force of Negation, and one Omnath, and I was like, I can't rip this card into three pieces and pitch it to all of them, and there's no way for me to draw another card that has all these colors. I think that that's, like, kind of a big issue when you start really diversifying your pitch spells, and it was already almost an issue for the smaller lists. Fire Ice was carrying a lot of weight to split Fury and Force of Negation, and, like, looking again at the deck that has Scion of Draco, like, there are four Leyline Bindings and four Scion of Dracos and 23 lands and, like, four footfalls. You can only pitch, like, I don't know, 20 cards in your deck to one of these spells. I think that is starting to reach the breaking point to them.
Yeah, the 23 land thing is still absolute lunacy to me in a deck which, as I keep coming back to, needs to hit its third land drop at minimum every single game. And then once you have only 23 lands, and some of those are like a Gemsu Canvas and a Fiery Islet and a Paseju, a lot of these are lands which are really not compatible with Leyline Binding in any meaningful way. And so I think you're going to double down on a lot of existing issues there, but maybe you have to do that to some extent just to get past this issue of, well, I have these three different pitch spells and I can't pitch everything to all of them all at once. And I guess in the 80 card version, this issue fixes itself to some degree because you can spend three to buy Yorion, which in that deck is more of a card to pitch on demand than anything else, but then, okay, I'm spending three mana on that instead of casting a spell, and at that point, I've lost the mana efficiency and the advantage that the three spells are meant to offer me in the first place. So, I don't know. I felt both the 60-card binding Rhino decks and the 80-card ones both had these deficiencies that I wasn't quite happy with.
Yeah, that's sort of where I'm at now. The Rhino's plan is pretty good, but I think there's some more work to be done on that archetype, even if Binding is a really good part of it.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, let's quickly talk about a deck that I just saw scrolling Twitter, which, now that I think about it in real time, made some sense, which is the Wilderness Reclamation deck with Leyline Binding, where you could build this as a four-color deck in the past, but one issue you had was a lot of the better removal that white would give you with Sorcery Speed, so cards like Prismatic Ending or Teferi Time Raveler, kind of negating some of the advantage of building your deck around Wilderness Reclamation. And so this is a nice instant speed universal removal spell that is also compatible with this like flash game plan, so that kind of makes a lot of sense. That being said, in the tweet that introduced me to this concept, the four color reclamation player is staring at a hand of Leyline Binding and Lightning Bolt against a pair of Phyrexian Crusaders. So that maybe there is still some work left to be done there.
Yeah, I have also, I do want to caution this, another reason to diversify from your Leyline Binding. The four Prismatic Ending, four Solitude, four Leyline Binding, like Azorius and four color decks really have a huge issue with Turok. I think that is something to really watch out for there.
Yeah, it's an issue with Turok, and it's also an issue against decks where none of those cards actually do anything. So if you get paired against one of these nightmare combo matchups, like your Calibrated Blast or what have you, like, those are going to be difficult regardless. But the fact that you have so many removal spells to the point where now you're guaranteed to have a decent quantity of dead cards left in your deck after sideboarding, even if you actually have a decent amount of stuff to bring in, that is an issue in your sideboard mapping that you can't really avoid there.
Yeah, Tron was my downfall when I was doing that. Though I will say, on that note of Wilderness Wreck, it is in the similar vein to the Scapeshift decks, like the Melton list that had adopted Leyline Binding. I think some of the like other lists had at it. The combo of Dryad and Binding is really, really good. Just like, you have this natural setup of not only Dryad just giving you all five types, no matter what you had to do in the previous turns, and no matter like the fact that Scapeshift has a million mountains, but like, you just naturally play another land after you play Dryad, and it's just the perfect follow-up. It's like a Shriek Maw, but Dryad is also a Dryad.
You do have the Dwarven Mine issue of, oh, I drew a Valakut, which is not a good land and also doesn't help towards Binding, but there's Dryad does like then fix that issue for you. It's almost a kind of a splashing for Birds of Paradise kind of situation there.
Yeah, I mean, if your Birds of Paradise was also like your almost primary win condition, but yeah, it was really impressive in those decks in the sense of like anything, like a lot of these discussions we're having are like, oh, how does this like not really fill all the gaps? I think that like one of the other things that Rhinos highlights and this deck highlights and creativity highlights is that like, what if you just don't care about killing all their stuff? You just need like a removal spell that will take care of stuff that's in the way of you getting to the point that you do something that is better than anything they can do, but like also covers some of your weaknesses. Like, I don't know, Bring to Light being shut off by Teferi. It's like, I don't know, I'll just Leyline Binding it.
Yeah,
I think that is a pretty big upside of the card that is underutilized in some of the more fair shells playing it.
Yeah, I think it's at its best in some of those combo control decks where, like you said, you need to line up one or two removal spells against specific things and then you're good to go, versus a deck like Four Color, or I guess the next deck we'll talk about in Azorius Control, which your entire raison d'etre is I'm going to interact with everything and then kind of win the game at my leisure. Leyline Binding, in one sense, does help you do that, in that it's another strong removal spell that lets you trade off with everything, but then does lead to some of those issues you described. And in Blue Eye Control in particular, this is a deck which can already be like a little clunky or have problems double spelling, and that's an inefficiency that especially like the DRC Ragavan decks can exploit sometimes. And so this is another deck where you really feel that issue of one mana binding versus two mana binding, or just having these additional triumphs in your deck to enable binding in the first place.
Well, I actually thought that binding, I think that Azorius is almost better suited to resolving the early inefficiencies than a lot of decks, just because of like, I think that like between ending and like counterspell, like it's kind of like roped into the whole Chalice game plan as well. And like, therefore has to play like this weirdly sort of like lower curve, like heavy on fire ice often. Like, it felt like that was kind of baked into your archetype already. So it wasn't a new problem and you were already trying to solve it. The thing I found with Azorius that I really liked was that you were like double spelling in those midterms was like way, way more important than it was in any of these other decks that I played, because the other decks, it's like with a combo deck, it's like, okay, I double spell, but like, when I play my Scapeshift, that counts as like a million spells, so who cares? My opponent dies. And like, Four Color, I made the hyperbolic statement of like, Four Color has a million ways to sort of double up on the mid game. Like, and that was pushed back. That was one of the comments you made or said that was called out. But really, it's like the entire Four Color deck is designed so that when you hit turn five, all you do is just like bury your opponent in two for ones, often most of which are like tempo positive of like, I'm going to Fury this and Solitude this. Azorius doesn't have that. It has to like play a Planeswalker and then kill your thing, and then it establishes the Planeswalker and it takes over. And Leyline Binding was really good there. But like, when playing Azorius, I feel like that was the only time where I felt like my Leyline Bindings were under attack by my opponent in a way that I cared about. Of all the decks that I've played so far with Binding, that was the one where it was really prominent, to the point that I don't think Leyline Binding has a place in Azorius. Whereas, like, comparing it to Four Color, if my opponent was throwing cards at my Leyline Binding, I did not care because they were not doing things that mattered. Like, they were just like, okay, so I killed something that you had already cast, and then you kill my binding, and now I've just gotten another turn of the game to proceed to the point of the game where I'm now going, like, Omnath, Fetch, Solitude, good luck.
Yeah, there's like a looming inevitability of, at some point, I'm going to traverse for Emrakul, or I'm going to do something, I'm going to cast this Urion, which then draws me three cards and flickers my Solitude. I can, once the game gets to that point, do something that just completely overpowers you, versus Blue Eye Control, where, like, if you're binding something and then your binding gets besieged while you're holding Counterspell, like, that potentially is just an outright disaster.
Yeah, and the other thing that I found came up with 4-color more than any of these other decks was that I would, like, fire off a binding early on a card just to take an action that was, like, a good use of my mana. And then later, I would just Teferi pick up the binding and have a binding back, and whatever they got back didn't matter. And that was absurd there. Or, like, the Teferi interaction actually came up against tokens a fair amount. Like, Rhinos especially, you could, like, binding a Rhino early and sort of vaguely reestablish and then pick up your binding later for free. Which is pretty cool. Another one that came up is that you can, like, binding a Renin 6 early, and then if your opponent plays another one, pick up your binding, the legend rule applies, and then you binding the second one.
Mm. Yeah, that's really nice. I think in Blue Eye Control, there is this issue with some of the alternatives, like Prismatic Ending in particular, where sometimes, let's say your opponent just played a 2-drop, and now you have this issue of, well, I could spend my entire turn 2 casting Prismatic Ending on that, or tapping low to cast it later on, but then I can't hold up the Counterspell or the Archmage's Charm that I've earmarked for their next threat, and so they then have a window to resolve something else, and I'm kind of in the same dilemma again next turn, and you feel like you're always playing this one turn behind, whereas Binding lets you kind of get to the point where, okay, I'll Binding this end of turn and then untap, and now I have, you know, shields up for whatever the next play is, and that it is much more conducive to the kind of game plan you want to be playing anyway. I do think one other issue with it in Blue Eye Control is Blue Eye has just a lot of good lands in it that don't have basic land types. So, like, Hall of Storm Giants, for example, really hard to overstate how good of a pickup that card was for Blue Eye Control as an archetype. It's easy to miss in the midst of everything else that was going on, but that really was a big deal, and that, you know, there's some tension there with Leyland Binding, or the one Otawara and the one Iganjo that you get to play for free. I think those are nice pickups to have for that kind of classic draw good control deck, but again, you will run into spots where those just prevent you from casting your binding in the way that you need to. Even stuff like, I'm not going to be defending Castle Vandris Hill or whatever, but even stuff like, okay, I've fetched my basic planes, and now Mysticate lets me cast my Counterspell on my Archmage's Charm. Again, Mysticate versus Leyline Binding. There are all of these implicit tensions that you run into, and I think that the sum total of just having the ideal mana base that you wanted before probably outweighs any additional utility that Binding can offer you.
Well, whoa. First off, like Castle Vandris is awesome in the Azorius decks, and I will not have any kind of disparagement of the second best land in the deck here. That said, you're entirely right about Mystic Gate and stuff being really important and, like, that not lining up. This might also just be a good bridge into the discussion of Binding versus Blood Moon, because Blood Moon is, like, a huge issue for Azorius, and I want to do anything I can to not have that be as big of an issue. And it's sort of hard to tell if Binding helps or hurts there. This also, like, bridges into the discussion of, like, the 4-color decks are better against Blood Moon than the Azorius deck, which it makes no sense to me still, but it just is how it is because of the way the lands line up. My experience was that So a lot of these decks that are playing Binding were previously bad against Blood Moon, so adding Binding doesn't cause an issue. But, like, for Rhinos, that would definitely be something on my mind that, like, that's going to be a huge issue. Another piece of that puzzle of, like, Binding versus Blood Moon is how often you want to fetch your basic planes. And I think that, like, creativity, that, like, obviously is just not a thing. In the Scapeshift decks, it's, like, 50-50. The 4-color decks, it was actively beneficial to have Binding in my deck against Blood Moon because I was already going for that basic planes in a lot of spots to, like, handle a turn on Raghavan and have a basic on the battlefield. And, like, yes, it does make Binding cost more if I only have two land types of Plains and Mountain, but, like, I'll pay 4 mana and kill their Blood Moon on their end step and then untap and win the game. So, like, I think that is something that is worth thinking about, where, like, if your deck was not previously bad to Blood Moon and would not want to fetch a basic planes, you're adding a new exposure to your deck.
Yeah, I think with 4-color, a lot of the time, just the naked basic planes often had issues with, you know, cards like Iteration, Counterspell, Coraddle, and so on. But yeah, you would often find yourself either wanting to fetch it or having to fetch it. And so the fact that, specifically compared to Prismatic Ending, you only need one basic to let you cast your card that is meant to unlock you from Blood Moon, that is a game-changing difference a lot of the time. Versus Prismatic Ending, yeah, sometimes you could get the basic planes, but then you also needed to find another basic, or you had to sneak an Abundant Growth underneath the Blood Moon previously, and that was easier said than done a lot of the time. The fact that now just having the planes is this gateway to unlocking everything else, that is a big deal. And this might actually be another benefit of the your Rhino set compared to some of these other decks, where you have the basic planes, and fetching it is not that bad for you a lot of the time, because again, it's not competing with all of these like color intensive two drops that don't include white. And also you have this other out of, well, sometimes I can just fetch my basic forest and cast Violent Outburst under Blood Moon, and that pair of Rhinos is going to get the job done themselves. I don't even need to answer the Blood Moon at all. So in a world where Blood Moon is increasingly popular, that might be an argument for the Rhino deck, or just for binding in general.
Yeah. I guess, like, moving on from Blood Moon, are there any other cards that are worth noting, like, how they specifically interact with binding? Because it does have some weird stuff. I know, like, Eidolon of the Great Revel, like, previously you could Boseiju it and not take damage, but not taking damage from that off of binding is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, that's a big one. I would say, like, against Amulet Titan, like, so this is another thing which it can answer a Dryad at instant speed versus Valakut Lions, which is big. Sometimes it's going to answer an Amulet that's coming into play off Urza Saga in a way that Prismatic Ending couldn't, where that might enable them to put this big turn together. But then the real question there is against the card from Evil Titan, where this is another answer that can just cleanly deal with that, except that the ETB trigger from your Titan can often hedge against the possibility of binding by just finding Boseiju and a bounce land, and then letting you blow up the binding and then getting that additional ETB trigger when the Titan comes back in. So it can be like a stopgap against the card from your Titan, and it's a good measure against just other things the Titan deck is doing, but it can't be the only piece of the puzzle there. As for other cards, there's an increasing amount of stuff which just like tries to win the game immediately, and binding is another catch-all against that. So the card Underworld Breach would be a good example, right, where often Prismatic Ending cannot do anything meaningful against that, and stuff like Unholy Heat or what have you couldn't either. Leyline Binding is another class of answers which, they're going to get some immediate value off Underworld Breach, but sometimes you can stop them getting a game-winning sequence off of it. And then in these like four-color mirrors or pseudo-mirrors, you have all of these weird lineups where, for example, like, you can't Prismatic Ending the opponent's Leyline Binding to unlock your card, and so that's a mark against Ending, which you can probably find some other good use for that, but you can binding your opponent's binding. And so you get into a lot of these weird back and forth fights where they binding your thing, you binding their binding to unlock it again. And the nature of these four color mirrors is all of these cards either explicitly or implicitly draw a card or do something else when they come back in. And so that sequence of kill your binding, get my thing back is often something which you're happy to do almost regardless of what that exchange is, or even if they're going to get the binding back. So let's say you play your Teferi, you bounce their binding, you get back your Renner 6, you plus it, you pick up a land. Well, now they have two things which they kind of need to binding again. And so even if they get to do that, they're doing it on their turn. So that's a mana down, first of all. But then, okay, so they get back the Ren, which they binding in the first place. Well, now you have a Teferi, which is ticking up, threatening to maybe just do the same sequence again in the following turn. And then if, let's say, the land that you got back was an Otawara or a Boseiju, well, now you're threatening the exact same sequence again. So in these mirrors, you get these really weird, like, back and forth leveling walls with both players' bindings, which are tough to work through sometimes.
Yeah, see, this whole discussion had me checking the text of binding, and I'm very sad to say you will not end up in the Oblivion Ring loop because it only targets your opponent's stuff, so I believe somewhere the chain has to break. So sadly, there will be no breaking Magic Online in that way. However, the four-color mirror already breaks the Magic Online clock most of the time, so that will have to be good enough.
And it breaks your spirit as well, unless you're built in a certain way.
Yeah, that mirror is just a lot of cards happening to each other. I don't have a lot of good things to say about it, and this binding thing is just another layer of that. What other binding decks are there? I mean, there's still a ton, but, like, are there any further down the line that are worth discussing besides the ones... I mean, I guess we talked about Domain Zoo here, right? And that is a binding deck that has shown up where it's just, like, significantly better than Path to Exile.
Yeah, it is excellent in the Domain Zoo deck. One other domain deck which popped up recently is the Aspiring Spike, kind of a Domain Delirium mashup deck. So this is a new take on 4-color or 5-color, I suppose, because this deck really does lean into both halves of that and into all 5 colors. So we have both Leyline Binding and Shadow Prophecy headlining these decks, along with some of the familiar suite that we've seen before of, you know, Ren and Six and Teferi and so on. So you can build, I think the spike list was 60 cards. You can build an 80 card version of this quite easily as well. So there's a lot of room to explore in that space. And then to transition seamlessly into Nonsense of the Week here, something which I had not seen much on Magic Online, although we did unearth a list here, but which I had seen in the wild was two different takes on Esper Reanimator using this domain sub-package of Leyline Binding and Shadow Prophecy. And even though this episode is about Leyline Binding, Shadow Prophecy is a card which flew under my radar during preview season and which has really impressed whenever I've seen it here, where just the rate on that card, instant speed versus sorcery speed is a big deal for that kind of effect. And then 3 mana 4, you know, look at top 5, draw 2. That's a decent impression of Dig Through Time just as it stands without needing too much setup beyond what you're doing anyway for your Leyline Bindings. And then if you are in one of these graveyard-themed decks, whether it's Delirium for Traverse and Unholy Heat, or these Reanimator decks where you're trying to get your big Trungus in the graveyard and find your reanimation spell to get it back, if you can get any kind of value from your graveyard, then Shadow Prophecy suddenly becomes one of the best draw spells that we've seen potentially ever.
Yeah, it's not quite Dig Through Time, because, like, 3 is still way more than 2, but it is close enough that, like, a couple of those as, like, I don't know. These decks have played stupid stuff like Izzet Charm. Shadow Prophecy is just way better. I know that some of the creativity lists had actually snuck this in, especially the ones leaning on Persist. I have some natural skepticism to that, just like a weird 3-drop on top of all your other 3-drops when, like, Prismari Command does multiple things better. But, like, it sounds like you're describing other decks where the Shadow Prophecy part of the card, like, that card is much more uniquely powerful in those shells.
Yeah, so you can put this in just old school Esper Reanimator, kind of the way you drew it up when I know you liked that deck around this time last year. But you can also revisit an old fan favorite in Esper Goryeo's Vengeance. So we can bring back our Obsidian or what have you the way we used to back when that was almost good enough. We can sneak in our Grizzlebrand and draw a bunch of cards. But this deck both uses this new package to good effect and also gets to exploit some of the MH2 standouts as well. So when you go as Vengeance of Grizzlebrand, you can attack, you can draw 7 cards, draw 14 cards. One of the difficulties has always been, how do you convert that into anything meaningful? And so in this deck, you have 4 Grief, you have 4 Solitude, and so you can draw a bunch of cards, and then you're going to find the Grief and a black card to pitch to it, or vice versa for Solitude. So you can actually meaningfully convert those cards into interaction, but also you can pair those with Ephemerate for the classic Grief plus Ephemerate lines or Solitude plus Ephemerate lines, which also give you another way to win the game in the absence of your graveyard staff. It gives you another 2-card combo essentially to dig for with your Shadow Prophecy. But the real kicker here is Ephemerate can save your Grizzlebrand from your Goryeo's Vengeance exile trigger. So you get your Grizzlebrand into play, you attack, you draw 7 cards, draw 14 cards. If one of those is an Ephemerate, you just Ephemerate the Grizzlebrand, and that one is just permanently around now as a 7/7 lifelinker, which is pretty hard for most decks to kill. And if they do, well, you've drawn 14 cards, so you can figure it out from there.
Yeah, in case it wasn't obvious, we have just seamlessly braged into Nonsense of the Week here, because this is definitely filed under Nonsense. This deck is literally just Esper with a Jetmir's Garden. That is that is where the state of Modern is right now with Shadow Prophecy and Leyline Binding in your deck.
Yeah, so the other notable parts here are Priest of Fel Rites as this MH2 backup reanimation card, which also brings back Grizzlebrand. Like, one issue with Persist is it is very explicitly meant to stop you bringing back Grizzlebrand, and so it has that non-legendary clause on it. Priest of Fel Rites, you're paying life, so that weakens your Grizzlebrand a bit, and you know, it doesn't have haste, so maybe you can't convert it into cards immediately, but sometimes you just bring back a Grizzlebrand, and that's good enough. And the fact that it has that unearth is another really nice thing with Shadow Prophecy, where sometimes your prophecy, you'll want to take, let's say, a solitude and a land, for example, to prolong the game, let you get your resources together. And in the process, if you're binning your Priest of Fell Rites and a Grizzlebrand, well, then you can work towards a stage where on turn 5, you unearth a priest, you bring back your thing, and you're good to go there. So does that, pitches to both of your elementals, just does all this good stuff. And then we also have this two-pack of Faithful Mending and Tainted Indulgence as these recent pickups for Reanimator, where these are good discard outlets, both of them. But also they have like good colors, I suppose, where like Mending pitches to Solitude, Indulgence pitches to Grief, and both of them are instant speed, which when Gorya's Vengeance 2 is also an instant, leads to some really fun lines where you go from doing like a decent impression of some weird Esper control deck to, oh wait, you tapped out and now I just have a Grizzlebrand and play out of nowhere, and you're kind of taken aback at what just happened.
Yeah, I also just really like that Faithful Mending is yet another card that you can bin incidentally off Shadow Prophecy, and
yes,
just like the chip shot life gain on that card really adds up when you're trying to counter the cost of Shadow Prophecy as well.
The other thing is that just drawing two cards with Prophecy is a big deal too, because one issue these decks tended to have was you're throwing cards away for, you know, pitch elemental plus ephemerae, or you had these two card combos where if you didn't have either half, the other one was useless, so you just have a Grizzlebrand you can't do anything with. And then with, you know, Faithful Mending was a really nice pickup from Midnight Hunt, but that one leaves you down a card when you cast the front end, and Tainted Indulgence cycles through cards, it's a discard outlet, but doesn't leave you up on cards, so it's very easy to just run out of resources, especially if those are under attack from your opponent, or you had to mulligan, or what have you. And so the fact that Prophecy kind of draws two cards, and then often will draw you, like, virtual fractions of additional cards is really nice there, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in this deck that looks really nice along those lines of adding up against the inherent card disadvantage of Reanimator. And, like, the Ephemerate Plan has been known for a while, but, like, that just feels like the Ephemerate Grief Plan feels like a way to sort of end up somewhere positive, as opposed to just like the Thoughtseize Plan. We were just like, I don't know, cards in my graveyard. I don't have anything left. Good luck to me.
Yeah, and like I said, if you want to do the classic thing of just persisting Archon, which turns out maybe the best deck in Modern at this point is all about getting Archon of Cruelty into play, well, you can run that setup too, and I think that would be just as successful.
Yeah, Shadow Prophecy is a card that I expect to see a little bit more of as time goes on. I don't know if all the pieces are quite there yet, but it feels like either Persist or Goryeo's Vengeance is like one good card away from hitting.
Yeah, and it's by design, I think, that you really can't Persist and Goryeo's Vengeance in the same deck. So that additional piece is going to have to come from somewhere else. But I think this is close, and this is certainly at the level where I would gladly run some leagues with this, run a challenge with this, or, you know, sleeve it up for a local event, for sure.
Yeah, that was Nonsense of the Week, so is there anything else you want to cover with Leyline Binding before we call it an episode?
I know in Pioneer people are trying to enigmatic incarnation into 7 drops ahead of schedule, where you almost don't care about the actual removal half of Leyline Binding, although that's certainly welcome, but you almost just want to exploit the fact that this technically costs 6, even though it never does in practice, and then cheat out some, like, Dragonlord Ataka or Agent of Treachery or something, and you can certainly do that in Modern, too. I know we've seen, perhaps in Nonsense of the Week, various takes on Enigmatic Incarnation in the past, and this is another level you could explore with that, I suppose.
Yeah, a list did 5-0 a league this week, and I just wanted to look and see what their 7 was, and it looks like the answer is just Agent of Treachery, and it's getting flickered the same way. But I guess Sarah Emissary is another option there, so there's some interesting stuff you can do along those lines. Also, like, I'm just, like, looking, like, Elidamri's Call is a pretty nice tutor upgrade, featuring the wonderful chain of turn 2 Elidamri's Call, turn 3 Moonbest Blessed Cleric, turn 4 cast your Enigmatic Incarnation. I don't know what other enchantment you have, but great. Yeah, it's kind of interesting there.
That does kind of lead to another point, which is that we've seen this debate ongoing over Traverse versus Elidamri's Call in 4 color. I wonder if Binding is a point in favor of the Elidamri's Call versions, where this is another instant speed effect you can hold up on the opponent's turn. And then also, I don't know if Traverse is maybe leading you to build your mana base in a way that's less conducive with Eladamri's, with Leyline Burning compared to Eladamri's Call?
I think it's also partly, like, you are less strained for a one-mana tutor when you have other powerful one-mana effects. I did play the list that top 8 of the challenge, and I was relatively impressed with Call. I finally, like, so I guess I do want to quickly comment on a couple of the one-off choices. The Tybalt was really bad. I would not play the Valky Tybalt if you played that deck. It came up, like, exactly once to kill a Kaldra, and even then it was just, like, interchangeable with any other big thing. The Titania was really good. I think previously that card did not solve the problems that 4-color really had, like, even, like, Elementals, where, like, it didn't really beat the decks undercutting you and, like, wasn't great. Like, it was interchangeable against a lot of the Izzet decks. I think now, like, with other decks, like, the Rakdos decks or whatever, trying to go head-to-head. Like, I was saying this thing where, like, there are a lot of decks that are trying to just go head-to-head with 4-color for 10 turns, but not 20 turns. They don't go head-to-head with Titania. Like, none of those decks come even remotely close to what that card does. So I would definitely look, even if you're not playing Risen Reef, I would look at including that card in your deck as, like, there's Emrakul at the top that bails you out against a large spread of stuff, but, like, Titania is the less, like, the lower end version of that same effect to kind of give you the two end game caps on what you're doing.
Yeah, I have wanted to explore a deck that's essentially Dryad, Risen Reef, Omnath, and some number of Titania backed up by the usual mix of, like, Incarnations and Eladamri's Call potentially, and then maybe you need Bring to Light to pair with Dryad to get Scapeshift, and then if you have the black source and Bring to Light for 5, you can also find Titania. So there's something in there potentially, but then I don't know if you end up just working your way towards the Bring to Light deck by a different method.
Yeah, I wonder if Titania is better than some number of the solo Wing Graces in the Melton deck, just as, like, even just one. Like, drawing multiple souls is kind of dicey. The, like, Soul was good, don't get me wrong, but, like, Titania is most of the same card for one more mana.
Yeah, I tried the Melton deck in the challenge very briefly this past weekend with a Titania in it over one of the souls, just on that basis. And my problem with that strategy was not a lack of impactful 4-drops and 5-drops, is how I remember that.
Really, you don't say. Yeah, that deck did have some troubles getting off the ground in some games, yeah.
I did get turn 2'd by goblins off the back of Gemstone Caverns, in fact, to add another point in that column where they went Gemstone Caverns into turn 1 Conspicuous Snoop, and then the moment they started tapping 3 mana on turn 2, I knew I was done for, and I almost wanted to applaud them for it, because, hey, that's cool as hell, and I'm glad to see Gemstone Caverns showing up in yet another deck with a suspiciously high mana curve.
Yeah, that is, I mean, I guess if you're adding, like, a 24th or 25th land or whatever it is to Goblins, that's a totally fine last land to add. At the same time, you do have a red-red 2-drop in your deck.
And a black-red 2-drop and Munitions Expert. And yeah, if you draw this card at any point, except when you are on the draw and it's in your opening hand, it's kind of a disaster. But, you know, you have to spend money to make money, I suppose. On that note, yeah, we will close out Nonsense of the Week and close out this episode here. So you can find us on Twitter at Dom and Javier and at ARMLX. You can find the podcast on Twitter at Dominaria_pod. You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/Dominaria_judgment. You can find our articles every week at SEG for me and CFB/TCG player for you now. I think is this a case of same office but new sign on the door?
Yeah, this was officially announced the day that we are recording this, was just sort of the reshuffle of TCG player and CFB's article content, given that, you know, the two companies have merged and also been bought by eBay and that whole thing, where it's, you know, very clearly delineating of, like, the CFB stuff is going in for the hard strategy. The TCG player stuff is where you're going to find a lot more of your finance side and commander and other sort of different, like, the other spread of Magic focus content. So, yeah, I am now on CFB, which means I guess I've completed the full gamut within a year, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, I guess there are no real, like, content hubs left at this point. You know, Brainburst died long ago, so I don't even know what you have to check off.
Brainburst is... That's not actually... Brainburst turned into TCG player. So I actually have... Yeah, yeah.
I see.
Yeah, so, you know, we can go through, but, you know, I think, you know, if you count, like, all the way back to, like, the Starkington Post, I think I've written for a lot of them.
Oh god, we're really going to like full boomer arrows at this point. But suffice to say, you were running Con Ed back then. You're still running it now. People should and can find it at cfb/TTGplayer, and then you can find us and Canister and many more people over in the Discord. So check the show notes, check our Twitter, and get the link there if you're so inclined. But I guess other than that, you can find us back here next week with more Magic of some description. And until then, take care, everyone.